It's been over 20 years since we last spoke. But before we go back and maybe talk about, the important things in your life and your music over the last 20 years, I always like to just find out how people are doing now. So, how's your day going? How's your week going? What's happening with you today?
Well, I'm sitting on the deck at our second home in northeastern Pennsylvania. My partner and I have a place out in the woods, and I've lived in Soho, in a very busy, now a very busy part of Soho, in Lower Manhattan for 36 years. So for the last 10 or so years, we've had this second place to get away. And I'm just kind of out here. I just got back from a swim. I'm working on some music. It's a beautiful day. The hummingbirds are out. And I'm having a nice tea. So it's a good day.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm jealous, to be honest with you. That sounds wonderful. Looking at a little bit of a longer time frame, I believe you've had quite a busy summer so far. Are there any highlights? What was fun in terms of your playing schedule this summer?
Well, it was great to have a lot of time with the trio. We had about 8 dates in Canada and the U northern U.S. during the Canadian festival circuit, and then we went right into the Village Vanguard for a week, and it was just great to play, with John and Eric as much as we have. It's been about 6 years. We're going to be recording our next album live at the Village Vanguard in October during my 60th birthday week for release next spring. So that's been certainly a highlight, just getting in some good time with them. And also in October, I have a music theater piece that's being produced called Rooms of Light, subtitle A Life, The Life of Photographs. It's a stage song cycle for 5 singers and 8 instruments and lighting and a director and all that. So we had a workshop for that the week before last, and we learned a lot. Got some stage time, got some time with the ensemble, with the actors and the director, and was really invaluable. And we're going back to the drawing board a little bit, but not too much. And that was certainly a highlight. I've been working on this piece for a long time, and it's finally getting produced, so that's kind of exciting.
Very exciting. I guess there's a couple other things that I would love to hear about. I know you've been through a lot of things, and I know that's probably a big understatement. And maybe I'll come at it from a slightly different angle. How is your relationship with Thelonious Monk these days?
My relationship with Thelonious Monk is very good. We play Monk all the time. I just came up with a new arrangement for the next album of a Monk tune. We did one on the last album, Let's Cool One. Just came up with, I think, a nice arrangement of We See. I always play Monk in a solo concert or a trio concert. It's kind of a constant. His tunes are often enigmatic and very stimulating and very rooted. And I think for so many years, people in that put me in that Bill Evans bin. And certainly my relationship with Monk and with other pianists, including Ahmad Jamal and Paul Bley and a bunch of Earl Hines and a bunch of other major influences, are really just as important, sometimes more so. So when I first started with a trio some 30 years ago, we were playing more standards. I wasn't writing as much music. Now we play a lot more of my own music, but Monk is, still a constant.
my question with Monk was also in part stemming from that, in terms of, and I'm very glad to hear that your relationship is good with him, and I wouldn't have expected much else, but was there a time when you I guess, wondered about the dreams and that one in particular with Thelonious? Did it feel like an uncomfortable position to be put in, to have to compete with somebody like that that you look up to?
You mean in the dream?
Yes.
No, actually not. I mean, we compose very, very differently. I know that sometimes he worked for years on and off and off on his tune. Everything he wrote, you know, his whole musical universe fits on about 70 or 80 pieces of paper, you know, but, you know, each tune has its own world, and even though a lot of them are similar in form, when I compose, I tend to compose generally fairly quickly, but still, even though it's more wide ranging, you know, I'd like to think that each one of my tunes has its own kind of world and set of rules and, you know, set of elements that should make it stimulating for the player. That's, you know, what Monk's music is. It's, you know, it leaves a lot to the player. I mean, it can be rearranged, it can be whatever, but it still has a certain monkishness about it, you know. It's like Bach, you know, you can play Bach on with a steel drum band and it still sounds like Bach. You know, you can play Monk in kind of any way you want and there's still an inherent monkishness about it. So, no, it didn't really bug me because, I mean, we're really different. I may have been the first or second person pianist to ever be perhaps foolish enough to attempt a solo Monk album. maybe it was kind of unexpected for the critics or for the audiences. But, you know, I've been deep into his music for a really long time.
Well, this is a great segue into another topic that I am interested in, and one of the ones I like to talk to jazz musicians about, and that has to do, I guess, with the language of jazz. What I'd like to understand is, what are the ingredients in your musical recipes, and have they changed over your career?
I think that things that interest me now have interested me my whole life, you know, moving inner voices, four parts essentially going on simultaneously, melody, surprise, tension and release. You know, these are elements that I find in, you know, a lot of the music I like, whatever genre it is, you know. Of course, you know, harmony and rhythm naturally, but you know, I find that, you know, in music from Western Africa and music by Joni Mitchell and music by classical composers, you know, it's the same stuff really. You know, it's a soup, you know, with just lots of ingredients, and you know, I think, you know, music advances by theft, you know. The beboppers were all hanging around each other and swiping stuff from each other, and so were the singer-songwriters in the late 60s, and so were the Viennese, both at the time of Beethoven and the time of Schoenberg, I mean, and the French in the time of Debussy and the expressionist artists in the 60s and the visual artists in Paris, you know, the impressionists. I mean, everybody swiped from everybody else, you know, and people were affected by other people's work they saw, but it was a question of, you know, being yourself. You know, nobody is without influence, but it's a question of what you do with that influence. Are you an imitator? Do you take that as a starting point and do something interesting and personal?
Well said. On, I guess, the same topic, because it's been a personal interest of mine, I believe I've heard you talk on the subject of Glenn Gould, and I'm just curious to hear what your interest in him has been and what you think of his playing and of course, the music he played.
Well, when I was very young, 6, 7, I got the recording of him playing Bach partitas, and it was a kind of a revelation to me. I still have the Bach set, partitas and inventions and sinfonias. He was such a pioneer in seeing a recording more as a film than as a document of a live performance. And he was a great philosopher about music, and I'm kind of a Gouldophile. You know, I've read a lot of books about him and things that he's written, and I have the whole, you know, all the Columbia CDs on the box set, you know, 60 or 70 CDs of all his records for Columbia. I've got big Canadian influences, Joni Mitchell, Glenn Gould, Paul Bley, there's all Canadian folks. Joni is, she's a touchstone for me for setting any kind of text, she's just one of the great, great artists of any genre that I can think of.
Another subject that I think about and would love to again hear your thoughts on, and what do you think swing is still important, and has it changed over the years? And when I say swing, I don't mean the swing era. I just mean swing as an element of music.
Yeah, I think I have a very authentic time feel in terms of playing swing. I mean, growing up, I learned by playing with older musicians that if you couldn't swing, they didn't really want to hear from you. I mean, it was just sort of, that's what separated the men from the boys, is whether or not you could swing. And, I think younger musicians are more involved with, complex metrical schemes and, time feel is still important. It's sort of the rhythmic currency of jazz musicians, whether it's, 4-4 or whatever compound meter it's in, or odd time signature. It's got to feel good. I think, I play with a band that, understands open playing, and they also can swing their butts off, And I can't really play with people who don't care about swinging, personally. That's not all I want them to do, but that is certainly a very important part of like when the trio is really swinging and we just kind of smile at each other. I mean, it's really nice, it's like we just have a very good rhythmic hookup, and that's very important to me. It's less so to a lot of younger musicians, they look in the real book and they learn 12 standards and rather boring keys and rather boring tempos and think, okay, that's jazz. And then they want to write their own music with their own band and put out their own records on their own labels, on their own websites, and they just skip that step, of apprenticing and, learning about it. I played with Joe Henderson for 10 years. I mean, he knew how to swing, and I played with Sam Jones. I played with people who could really do that and also be incredibly creative within that. So, maybe my jazz hero is probably Sonny Rollins, he's kind of consummate jazz musician, great improviser and technician and sense of humor and intellect and just, but, swing is, I mean, his time feels is just ridiculous. It's so great. You listen early ornate coma, and it sounds like Bird. I
Yeah.
mean, you know, more the further you get from it, the more it sounds like Bird.
This is another good opportunity for a segue to a fun question here. If you could go back in time and spend 1 week, so you can go back to one place in time and spend a week in a specific place with a particular person or group of persons who would have been in that place, anything come to mind?
Oh, there's so many, actually. I've never been asked that question. I mean, maybe, you know, Stravinsky in Paris in 1913 or 14 would be pretty interesting. Walt Whitman about 1860. John Cage about 1960. Those would all be pretty interesting people and times.
Wow. Yeah, that's an interesting list.
I met John Cage when I was 10.
Oh, you did? Did you? Okay.
Yeah, I was already composing music, and he actually stayed at our house. My teacher in Cincinnati had recorded his player piano music and prepared piano music, so she gave a concert and he stayed with us. And you know, I was a composer then at 10, and I talked to him about music, but now there's so many questions I would like to ask him that I didn't, of course, ask him then because I was 10.
Fascinating. What types of things would you like to ask him?
I'd like to ask him about all kinds of stuff, his life and his music and his kind of philosophy about, you know, chance elements, and he just seemed like a very interesting, cool guy, you know, and he was, you know, also gay, but it didn't define him. And he had a lifelong relationship with Merce Cunningham, which must have been pretty interesting. In a way, his writings and his philosophy are as interesting or more interesting than his music, but he would just be an interesting person.
You just reminded me of another topic that I'm perhaps interested in hearing from you on. Maybe you don't have much to say about it, but I've actually spent some time in Cincinnati over the more recent years. I would imagine that, you know, in earlier times, and maybe even today, that there was a pretty neat music scene in Cincinnati, and wonder if maybe you have any thoughts or impressions about what you recall of Cincinnati or what you know of it as a... I mean, I don't know how much time you spent there, but I know you did spend some time there.
I lived there for 19 years, and I go back often, and my mom is there, and I'm, you know, I'm really know a lot about it, actually, the history, and, you know, it was a very good place. You know, it has an excellent conservatory and a beautiful music hall and one of the better symphonies in the U.S., and, There was a network of jazz clubs and folk clubs and bluegrass joints, and it was pretty thriving and kind of still is. The main jazz club there closed its doors after about 30 years. It's a full-time jazz club called the Blue Wisp, but, you know, people are finding places to play. And but, you know, there was a great group of older musicians who were very kind to me and took me under their wing and gave me some tough love. And I'm in the midst of writing a memoir, an autobiography, and it's going to be kind of a big book. We have a deal with Random House, the Crown Division of Random House, which is one of the better publishing companies, and it should be out, you know, probably a year from, you know, probably early 2017. We're going to deliver it in less than a year, next May. I'm working with a collaborator, but I'm doing a lot of it myself. And, you know, I've been spending a lot of time going back to those formative years in Cincinnati, and I was pretty lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Also, late in the 70s when I moved to New York, I was in the right place at the right time, too. So it's just good luck there.
That's interesting that you say that about New York, because some people might have the impression that the 70s was sort of a low point for jazz, but it sounds like you might differ. You might beg to differ.
Well, it was pre-institutionalization, you know, pre-jazz at Lincoln Center and all that kind of stuff, you know. Jazz was just kind of a more underground, and everybody kind of hung out, and, you know, people were accessible, and there were still great sideman jobs, and, you know, people would come out and drink and drug and support the music, and, you know, it was kind of more glamorous, you know, to me than it is now. Now it's more, you know, institutionalized, and they're, you know, schools spitting out students and, you know, young musicians. Yeah, I mean, the city was falling apart in the 70s, you know, late 70s, but I didn't care. It was cheap, and I lived in the village, and I thought it was pretty cool.
Who if you will, I know that you played with Art Farmer and stuff. I've seen some of your early recordings playing with him. That would have been, I guess, I mean, when you sort of hit the scene in terms of becoming well-known, and maybe in my mind it's about 1980, but what was maybe some highlights from the 70s in New York? Who were you playing with? And
Well, Sam Jones was a huge mentor, the bassist. And,
yeah.
You know, playing at places like Bradley's with all kinds of wonderful bass players, and just lots of, you know, jam sessions, being in the house band in different clubs that had different soloists every weekend, and being, you know, I mean, some of it was not glamorous, playing in restaurants, playing the Catskills, playing, you know, background music, playing, you know, shitty paying gigs or playing with bad singers. You know, it was not, you know, not all of it was glamorous, but, you know, I was not driving a cab, at least.
Yeah, it sounds like great times. I did have a chance to chat rather briefly with a student of yours, Ethan Iverson. I don't know if you stay in touch with him or not.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, he's very interesting and very articulate. He has one of the best jazz blogs, Do the Math. And there's a very extensive interview with me, actually, that he did that led, in a weird way, to me doing this book that I'm doing. You know, he was very interested in that early time and early years in the 70s, you know, because people sort of forget the 70s in jazz. I mean, there was so much that happened in the 60s. I mean, Ornette, Coltrane, Miles' great quintets, you know, electronics entering jazz, you know, Bitches Brew, Mingus. I mean, there was so much going on in the 60s. Kind of, you know, people think of the 70s as, you know, ECM and Return to Forever and Weather Report and the beginning of smooth jazz and New Age. And, you know, the business wasn't thriving. I mean, the major labels were dropping jazz, and, you know, with a few exceptions, a lot of icons passed away. Duke Ellington passed away, and Monk stopped playing, and Miles kind of retreated, but it was still thriving. I mean, you know, Art Blakey was out there 50 weeks a year, and, you know, there was, you know, there were a lot of bands that worked, and there was a network of clubs and people that supported the music in their own way, and the fusion groups made money more than the acoustic groups, but, you know, it still kept going. But it was more of a well-kept secret in a way. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like, you know, 12-year-olds going to summer jazz camp at Stanford.
Yeah, maybe perhaps underdocumented.
Maybe underdocumented, but that's every suburban kid who can play a 12-bar blues thinks he wants to be a jazz musician, you know, and it's a lot harder than that, you know, and as an educator myself, I mean, I've trained some people who've gone on to be big, big deals, but I've also trained a lot that, you know, I might have said, hey, you know, think about a better way to earn a living, because mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to actually be able to do this.
I guess you know you've given me again a lot of time. Maybe when your next album comes out, we can do a follow up because I
sure. Well,
sure
I have
can
a
talk
live
about.
solo album coming out September 4th, kind of in time for my birthday, and then I'm finally actually first time going to be on the cover of Downbeat for October, which is kind of nice.
First time?
First time, yeah.
Wow.
Never been on the cover of a jazz magazine before.
Wow, that's shocking, but well deserved.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. Now I'm way up in the critics' polls, and maybe this is my time. Overnight success at 60 or something. I don't know, but
it's definitely well deserved. Definitely well deserved.
Well, we'd like to think so, but it's nice when it happens. There never any guarantees, and that's not why you do it. Keep doing it because you love it and because you think you're getting better at it. I hope I'm getting better at it, and I want to keep getting better at it.
Well, I would put a yes down on that one.
All right. Well, thanks. Thanks so much for your interest, and nice talking to you. Thanks for the good questions.
My pleasure, Fred. I really appreciate it, and I'll be keeping an eye out on your calendar, and maybe we can chat again.
That'd be fine. Thanks so much.